We don't have very much time right at the moment, but let's get in what we can. We were discussing the E2 reaction last lecture, and we were discussing a bit of stereochemistry related to that E2 reaction. We had seen a couple of different substituted cyclohexane compounds, and we were trying to figure out whether elimination would occur on those particular compounds or not. So we had seen one example originally where the leaving group and the hydrogen being pulled off were trans to each other on that ring. And then I had posed the question of what would happen if you had a similar molecule where those hydrogens and leaving group were cis to each other instead. So let's investigate that, and then we'll wrap up with the E1 reaction. So I believe our example might have been, oh dear. During the break, I'll see if I can play with the color balance at all. But we had a compound like this, where next to the leaving group on one side, we had two methyl groups, which means there's no removable hydrogen at that position, so elimination will not occur from that side. And on the other side of the leaving group, we have a hydrogen and then a methyl group. So there's only one hydrogen that could be removed on that other side. The question I had posed is, would that elimination be able to occur? Did anybody read up on this problem, or were you understandably just focused on the quiz? Well, let's draw a chair structure for this. Oops, that would be wrong. Hold on. No, actually, that was right. Please go back and change the original structure. I don't know why I wrote two wedges on the same carbon, but not going to happen. So there's our two methyl groups. We could write bromine in the axial position, and then its hydrogen in the equatorial position. And that's going to mean that the hydrogen in the next carbon over is in the equatorial position, while the methyl group is in the axial position. So that's one possible chair structure. We could draw the ring-flipped version as well. So there's our two methyl groups. Here's bromine still pointed up, but now in the equatorial position, which will force the hydrogen axial. And then the other version, we have the hydrogen axial, which is going to put the methyl group equatorial. Do we have either syn-periplanar or anti-periplanar geometry in either one of these cases? Well, let's see if we can determine that. What if we were to make a rotamer diagram looking along this bond axis? Now, way back when we did ring compounds and we did rotamers originally, I never did have you responsible for writing a rotamer diagram for a ring compound because I knew we would do it right here. Because what would this look like as a Newman projection? Well, the bonds that are closer to us will be the ones that we write with lines going all the way through to the center, and then the ones that are further behind this virtual disk, will not be drawn all the way through. Bromine in the back is pointed up, the hydrogen is pointed down and to the right. In the front, the methyl group is pointed down and the hydrogen is up. And then I could just, for simplicity, connect these other two substituent positions because they're just the ring. Now, if you're having difficulty visualizing this, you are still allowed to use model sets. That hasn't gone away. So I suggest making a model to try to convince yourself that this is the correct type of projection. Let's do the same type of Newman projection for the other cyclohexane version, the ring-flipped version. And This one's going to be a little bit tougher one to visualize. And I'm going to visualize it from here. So from that perspective, the hydrogen's going to be pointed straight down. We're going to have the bromine pointed out to our left. Realize that we're looking from the molecule from this side. Bromine is actually kind of pointed out this direction at us. I know with the way I've written it on the paper, it's hard to visualize. So again, make the models to convince yourself we're doing this correctly. We'll then have the rest of the ring going off to the right. In back, it's a little bit easier to see. The methyl group will be pointed down to the left. The hydrogen will be pointed straight up. And then we'll have, again, the rest of the ring pointed out the other direction. In either case, the dihedral angle between the hydrogen that can be removed versus the leaving group is 60 degrees. You have to have either 0 degrees or 180 degrees in order for elimination to occur. When we had the removable hydrogen and the leaving group trans to each other, then one of the ring flip versions did have a 180 degree angle. We did not do the Newman projection there, but that would be a little bit of homework for you to do, to go back and make the Newman projections similar to what we just did here. And when you do that, you will find one of them is not 180 degrees, but the other one is. So elimination will not occur in this compound because it never can achieve the correct geometry. Yes.
For the first Newman projection.
Yes. Wait.
Yeah, shouldn't that be 120?
Of course it should. Which makes sense, because you're ring flipping 180 degrees inverted. Now let me briefly introduce the E1 mechanism. And what we're going to end up doing is having, because we end up taking more time for the quiz than I originally intended, we will have our workshop discussion in lab lecture today. But let me at least show you the mechanism for an E1 elimination. E1 is called E1 because it's unimolecular, meaning only one reagent is present in the rate-limiting step. And in fact, it's exactly the same initial rate-limiting step as we have for SN1. Which actually has an immediate important consequence, since it is exactly the same intermediate as the SN1 reaction. It is impossible to have an E1 reaction without at least the possibility of forming substitution products as well. Similarly, you can't have an SN1 reaction without there being the possibility of E1 occurring as well. Again, because they both go through exactly the same intermediates. So let me make a side note of that. Since the exact same intermediate, is formed at the beginning of both the SN1 and E1 reactions. They will always occur together. As far as which one are you going to end up with more of happening, it's going to depend on primarily solvent, maybe the size of the nucleophile, or temperature. I say maybe the size of the nucleophile because recognize that the rate limiting step of this reaction doesn't depend on the nucleophile. But you could argue that maybe there's some kind of secondary effect afterwards. But focusing on the elimination mechanism for the moment, once the carbocation forms, you're going to have a more active overlap with neighboring sigma bonds. You'll have hyperconjugation. And so you can imagine that what if that intensified so much that the electrons from that hydrogen just end up completely overlapping with the p orbital. So if we had some kind of weak nucleophile come along and pull the hydrogen off, will form a triple bond. Now let's just briefly go through those six aspects of the reaction. At least let's get them written down. We'll be out of time then, but we'll pick this discussion right up when we come back to lab lecture. So in terms of utility, alkyl halide or, of course, our sulfonates forming an alkene. The reagents, weak, non-basic nucleophiles. If you had basic nucleophiles, E2 would happen instead, which is exactly the type of discussion that we're going to have. As far as conditions, same as SN1. Polar protic solvents. You have the mechanism up above, and this discussion we'll have next week when we start alkenes, but it's still going to be true that more substituted alkenes are formed preferentially. So in terms of regiochemistry or stereochemistry, I'll combine those and say more substituted alkenes form. But actually separating out the regiochemistry, recognize that carbocation shifts can occur. They wouldn't in this example that I showed you because you have a tertiary that would much rather be a tertiary than a primary possibly forming. But in other cases, you could have migration. So we'll pick up with this in lab lecture. For question one, this was the question about the three different types of carbocation. So you had the same original molecule, but you had shown a primary versus secondary versus tertiary carbocation. And you were told that the tertiary carbocation forms more rapidly than the secondary versus the primary, and you're asked to explain this behavior. This is hyperconjugation. Now, you did not have to write Smong diagrams for all three carbocations. In fact, I will just answer for one, and I'll do the answer that was the most common answer, which is to do the carbocation for compound C, the tertiary carbocation itself. So ST2 hybridization. SP2 hybridization on that central carbon. Which means it's going to have a p orbital on it. SP3 hybridization for all the other carbons. So we'll have two methyl groups. and then an ethyl group. Shouldn't forget the hydrogens that are there. And it makes sense to show the hyperconjugation that's going to occur to make this a stronger diagram for supporting the answer, which is that for this tertiary carbocation, because we do have three different neighbors that the overlap can occur with, that provides more stabilization than if we had had a secondary carbocation or a primary carbocation. Now, the types of mistakes I saw in general in this problem were particularly for the primary and secondary carbocation. If you drew those instead, of figuring out which neighbors does the overlap actually occur with. So notice I have not drawn this hyperconjugation interaction connecting to the last carbon on the right there, because it's really too far away for it to have an interaction with the p orbital. So it's only the neighbors that really are on the next atom over that are going to have the possibility for hyperconjugation. Also, hyperconjugation, the examples of it that we've seen so far, all involve just one p orbital, and then with it's the interaction with neighboring sigma bonds. Some of you had instead drawn conjugation, where you drew a p orbital on each of the carbons, but those p orbitals don't exist if you have sp3 hybridization. So just be careful that you are making the difference between conjugation and hyperconjugation. Questions on that problem? Yes? It kind of depended on what kind of error was made. So if you made a mistake in the smog diagram, in fact, the most common problem was labeling this as compound C, but then leaving off the last methyl group. So if you labeled it as C, but you had trimethyl instead of an ethyl group on there, that was 2 points. Unless you had some other structural mistakes, then it was, I think, 5 or 6 points might have been the maximum I took off for that. If you had p orbitals on each carbon, or if you're missing p orbitals entirely, then that was a between 4 and 6 points, depending on how many of the carbons that you had made that mistake on. I don't think there were any other cases outside of that as far as the structure drawing. And I think everybody correctly answered that it was the tertiary that had more hyperconjugation. So the point ranges probably were between 19 and 25 for this problem. So the second problem, oops, I need my own copy now. Oh yes, that was the resonance structure problem. So you are given the allyl anion, and you're asked to draw a SMOG diagram for the allyl anion. So let's do that first, because in fact that gets to the heart of the problem, that although we may write the structure using either one of these resonance structures, they are actually the incorrect structure for the molecule. So you can't use these to generate your SMOG diagram, because that SMOG diagram would not actually reflect what allyl's true structure is. So it in fact has sp2 hybridization on all three of the carbons. So since there's sp2 hybridization on each of the carbons, you're going to have not hyperconjugation, but conjugation in this case. Again, we don't want to forget the hydrogens. So that's the SMOG. You're asked to explain how and why neither resonance structure correctly shows the structure of this anion. So the how you could express in a couple of different ways. One, the electron pairs, the negative charge
isn't really localized on any one particular carbon, as the resonance structures have it. Or the more common way that you all expressed that was to say that one of the carbons in the structure is sp3 hybridized and the other two are sp2 hybridized. But that's exactly where the structure fails to describe really what the allyl ion looks like. And that's because line structures, which are a form of Lewis dot structures, are incapable of showing delocalized electrons. It's a writing system that can only handle bonds between two atoms. So questions on that problem? About roughly the same for this one. If you had written a smog that was based off of one of these resonance structures, I think that might have been for, I forget if it's 4 or 5, I think it was 5 points for that one. And then if you failed to indicate how it failed, in other words, if you didn't say how is it that the individual resonance structures failed to show the true structure of the allyl ion, that depending on what your degree of not commenting on it was, again, between about 2 and 5 points. Okay, third question, the mechanism question. So we had two starting materials. One of which was a primary alkyl halide, one of which was a tertiary alkyl halide. You were told that the primary alkyl halide reacts with sodium hydroxide, and you were told that the tertiary reacts with water. You were asked to write complete mechanisms for both of these reactions. So with the primary substrate, that's the SN2 reaction. And although we've had a lot more information about SN1 and SN2 since the exam, you were required to know the SN1 and SN2 mechanisms, and this is either identical or almost identical to the examples that had been in class. So for the SN2 mechanism, it's concerted. And because it's concerted, that means that you're going to have inversion of configuration. Now, in these mechanism questions, if you had an arrow pointing the wrong direction, that might have been worth either 1 or 2 points, depending on how many arrows that you did have wrong. If you left out an entire step, depending on how many steps there were. Well, of course, there was only one step here, so you couldn't leave that out. But for the one we're about to get to, if you left out an entire step, that was either 2 or 3 points, depending on which of the steps that you left out. On this first problem, if you failed to show inversion, then that was worth 3 points. Let's draw the mechanism for the second one. So here, the bromine leaves first. Forms a carbocation. Water comes into attack. Now, there were several of you that tried to turn water into hydroxide. But recognize that neutral water has an almost zero quantity of H plus and hydroxide there formed. And that trace amount that forms so quickly recombines again that it's not really an appreciable quantity to be a reactant. So H2O is never, ever the same thing as H plus and OH minus, at least within organic chemistry reactions. So it really is going to be water that attacks in the second case. But when it attacks, you end up forming a stereocenter. Now, if you only showed one of the products as you wrote the mechanism, and then at the end you said plus enantiomer, that was good enough.
because I just wanted to know that you knew that there was an enantiomer there. So kind of like on the first problem, if you didn't show inversion on the first problem, if you didn't show that there was an enantiomer on the second problem, then that was also worth 3 points. So matching many of the answers I saw, I'll just draw one product at first. This is probably the most commonly missed arrow right here, is the deprotonation of the oxygen. The hydrogen comes off, but the arrow does not show which way the hydrogen goes. It shows which way the electrons go, and the electrons go back to the oxygen. So once that deprotonation occurs, we have a neutral alcohol, and now at this point, I'll go ahead and write in both of the products. Questions on that problem? Okay, moving on to number four. Number four was the reaction coordinate diagram problem. So this problem, the grade that you would have received partly depends on the answer that you gave for number three. Because since you were writing reaction coordinate diagrams based on your mechanisms, if, for example, in the second mechanism you only had two steps, then it would have been acceptable to have a reaction coordinate diagram that only has two steps. But in reality, there is this third step where you do have the deprotonation. So if everything else was correct in your diagrams, but you missed that deprotonation at the end there, then that would have been worth 3 points. You were asked to label the transition states, the intermediates, the reactants, the products, and the axes. So generally those would have been roughly 1 point each, although if you had multiple omissions, at some point I kind of cut you some slack, and maybe if you had four things missing, I only took off 3 points, for example. For the first reaction, there is only going to be one transition state because it is a concerted reaction. And you were told in the problem it's exothermic, so you had to make sure, and it would have been fine then to assume energy was in terms of enthalpy, but you had to make sure then that that product was going to be lower in energy than your reactants. You're asked to label reactants and products. And then again, you are also asked to label the transition state, which there's only one in this case, and the activation energy, which again, there's only one of in this case. Now, if you had the correct mechanism, all three steps for the SN1 reaction, then your reaction coordinate diagram should also have three steps in it. Now, you were only told that the overall reaction is exothermic. So in some ways you would not have been able to correctly place the energy levels for the intermediates. And so I didn't look at that, except that the first step of the reaction is the formation of a carbocation, is therefore a bond breaking event. And so at the very least, your first intermediate should have been higher than the reactant in energy. Because the first step is also the rate limiting step, you needed to make sure that you showed the first step having the largest activation barrier. But the position of the second intermediate, therefore, you might not have known, and in the way that I graded it then, didn't matter. So we have a reactant, a product, and two intermediates. The intermediates are the local minima. So the top of the curves, those are the transition states. Some of you have confused what transition state and intermediates are, though. So the intermediates are the local minima, these species that form just for a moment in solution. So here are the two transition states. And now there are three forward activation energies. Notice that the activation energy is written from either the reactant or the intermediate that is immediately preceding that transition state. So you don't write each activation energy in comparison to the original reactant. You only do that for the first transition state. Yes?
I have a question. For one of the nucleophilic substitution that has two steps to it, how long are yours on 3 months? That's in the notes.
Because there's three steps. So first step is the nucleophile comes off. That would be the largest activation barrier. Second step would be attack of the water. That's that activation barrier there. And then you have the dissociation of the water, so third reaction step. And more recently, when we covered these reactions again, I showed you an example of iodide being nucleophile, and that did not have a third deprotonation step, so that doesn't have a third pump, you could say, on the reaction coordinate diagram. But because we do have that bond dissociation energy, you do have a third step. So it's back to what we covered in equilibrium, is the number of transition states, or not equilibrium, kinetics. Number of transition states equals number of reaction steps. And if you have something like this where you have deprotonation, if you have some follow-up reaction after the nucleophile attacks, then yes, for every step after that, you need a transition state. Now, this is part of the question. The other part of the question is the fact that both the nucleophile and the substrate, their concentrations matter for the rate of the first reaction, but only the concentration of the substrate matters for the rate of the second reaction. And that's because of what is in the rate-limiting step. So for the first reaction, there's only one step. So automatically, both of the reactants are found in the rate law, so automatically both of them have effect on the rate of reaction. For the second one, though, it's only that first toughest step, the rate-limiting step, the formation of that carbocation, that is going to control the rate of the reaction. And since only the substrate matters for forming that carbocation, that's why only the substrate affects the rate of reaction. So other questions about this problem? All right, let's move on then to number 5, which was about stereochemistry. So as we can see from the SN2 mechanism, we're only going to make one product. But you can't say that just because it has a stereocenter, that's why the solution is chiral or optically active. Because you could have a meso compound, and meso compounds have stereocenters but are achiral. So you do have to say that it does have a stereocenter, but you also have to specifically say then it is chiral, which is why it is optically active. Then for reaction B, the reason that you don't see optical activity there is because you have a racemic mixture where you have exactly 50-50 balance of both enantiomers. And so since the optical rotation of one cancels out the other, that's why you end up with an optically inactive solution. Yeah? Yes, but the reverse isn't true. Just because you say there's a stereocenter doesn't mean it's going to be chiral. And the example of that is a mesomolecule. So questions about that problem? Okay, then number 6 was... Oh yes, naming. So let's do those really quickly. First one, cyclohexane derivative. So this is cyclohexanol. It is an alcohol, so it's the alcohol functional group ending. Because there's only one of that most important functional group, you don't actually use the number. So this name is going to end in just cyclohexanol. We've got 3 substituents, a deuterium and then 2 methyl groups. The D in deuterium comes lower than the M in methyl. And even though you're going to say dimethyl, even with that di, it would still come after deutero. But you don't even look at the di to alphabetize. You look at the M and methyl. So we're going to list deuto first, methyl second. Since the alcohol is the most important functional group, numbering starts from that position. So we're going to have 2-deutero-4,4-dimethyl. That would almost be complete, but we do have stereocenters. We've got two of them. The top one isn't a trick question, but it does appear to be a stereocenter because you've got dashes and wedges. But since they're both methyl groups, since you've got two of exactly the same substituent, that means it isn't really a stereocenter. So position one and position two we need to determine. For position one, oxygen's more important than carbon, so it's automatically priority one. Then we have we've got two halves of the ring, and they're different from each other. The left half has a deuterium, the right half doesn't. Deuterium has precedence over hydrogen. So it looks like it's 1, 2, 3. So it looks R, but the hydrogen, or the least important group, is actually pointed towards us, so we have to reverse what we see, so it's actually S. Then for the other stereocenter, we have two carbons and a deuterium attached. We have a carbon with an oxygen, then we have a carbon without an oxygen. So the carbon with the oxygen is more important than the carbon without the oxygen. And then we have the deuterium, so 1, 2, 3. That one is also S. So the full name is 1S, 2S, 2-deutero, 4,4-dimethyl cyclohexanol. Yes? It is technically, but I may end up throwing some points back for that, some rounding points at the end of the quarter, because it is such a minor rule. But when you look up the compound, you won't find it as cyclohexane 1-ol. It is just cyclohexanol. Yes? What's that? Or what I'll probably do is just universally add, because I tend to do that at the end of the quarter anyways, just add some rounding points to everybody's scores. And I tend to, just to let you know, yes, you have that the mechanism where the exam will replace your lowest test if, in terms of percentages, your exam is higher than your lowest test. But then I'll look at the grade distribution and I think, okay, what if I wrote a rough final? Then I usually throw in like a 5 to 15 point buffer just on top of everybody's scores. Now the other problem another alcohol. So the longest carbon chain here is 7 carbons long, so it's going to be some form of heptane, but it's going to be an alcohol, so it's a heptanol, except we have 3 alcohols, so it's a heptane triol. So now, there's 2 different ways that we play with these base names, something like hexane. If we have an alkene or an alkyne, it's the ane part of the name that changes. So we could go from hexane to hexene to hexine. When we have an alcohol, you're changing what comes after that. The point of saying this is that for alcohols, the N, like in hexane, pentane, is always there. So if you think of, just if you had a single alcohol, that would be hexanol. You drop the E just so the E and the O don't clash. But if you have a triol, that means you're going to have the full name, heptane triol in this case. The lowest position we could number it would be if we gave the right-hand most alcohol the one number. So this is going to be heptane 133 triol.
Now we need to worry about the substituents. There's an ethyl substituent and two methyl substituents. Even though it's dimethyl, again, the di part doesn't get alphabetized. So we're going to put ethyl first and then the two methyls. So ethyl, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 position, and then 2 and 4 for the methyls. And I didn't quite leave myself room here, but we do have stereocenters again. And again, we only have two stereocenters because the end here where the two ethyls are connected, that's the same substituent, so it won't be a stereocenter. Where the two OH groups are connected, same substituent, also no stereocenter. So it's going to be positions 2 and 4 that are chiral because each of those has 4 different substituents. So let's handle position 2 first. We've got a carbon with 2 alcohols or 2 oxygens, a carbon with 1 oxygen, and a carbon with no oxygen. So 1, 2, 3, it looks S, but the least important group is pointed towards us, so it's really R. So that's 2R. Then for position 4, you have carbons with alcohols, you have carbon with just carbon, and then you have carbon with just hydrogen. So 1, 2, 3, that looks R. The least important group pointed at you, so it's really S. So the full name is 2R4S5-ethyl-2,4-dimethyl-heptane-1,3,3-triol. Questions about nomenclature? All right, then the last question was about equilibrium. And it was about this, what's known as esterification reaction. Very, very, very common reaction where you take a carboxylic acid, cook it up in a heavy amount of alcohol with a little bit of an acid catalyst, which I did put in there as well. Type of reaction, leave overnight, come back the next day, and you have your ester. So you're first asked to give the 3 definitions of equilibrium, which I think everybody did. So just to remind ourselves, though, it's where you have no apparent change in the concentration of reactants or products, where you've reached the lowest energy point in the system, and where the rates of the forward and reverse reactions are equal to each other. You were then asked, how could you affect this reaction to push this to making products, to force the reaction to go to completion? So the answer that nearly everybody gave was to remove products, which is what you really did in one of your labs. By removing products, what happened? Well, you lowered Q below K, which is the concentration argument. And I'm making this argument because you were asked to explain this Le Chatelier's effect in the context of those 3 definitions of equilibrium that you had given. So if the 3 definitions were about concentrations, rates, and energy, you needed to refer to each one of those. So for concentration, you drop the concentration of products down, makes Q lower than K, so more products want to form to reestablish equilibrium concentrations. In terms of rate, if you drop the amount of products, then your forward reaction rate's going to increase, but not your reverse one. So it's again going to move the reaction forward. And then in terms of energy, if equilibrium is the lowest energy point of the system, then if you do anything to disturb the equilibrium, automatically you're going to be higher in potential energy. And so the reaction is going to go towards lower energy again. Now, what about the catalyst? You were asked, why does the, what was the phrasing? Why adding a catalyst will not change the balance of products and reactants found at equilibrium? Well, because the activation energy, the catalyst affects activation energy, so it affects how fast the reaction is going to occur, but it actually doesn't change what the reactant is or what the product is. And in equilibrium, that balance depends on what is the energy of the reactant and product. So it's really Hess's law. Hess's law says it doesn't matter how a reaction occurs, it's still going to have the same overall energy change. Since energy change is related to equilibrium,
That's why the catalyst has no effect on equilibrium. Questions? Okay. Oh, yes.
I know we need one thing now to learn is that we can start to remove the products before we keep going, right? What, given this particular reaction, what are the only other ways to do it to force it to remove the product?
What you could also do in this case in real life is to add a whole bunch of the alcohol. So if you keep adding to the reactant sides, that's going to push it to products as well. Now, if you add product, that will make it go back to the reactant.
The
acid, yes. In real life, generally, the alcohols that you esterify with, though, tend to be cheap, and the acid's more expensive, and so you tend to use the alcohol as the one that's in excess.
And that's the other way. Just the amount?
Temperature would have an effect, but we'd have to know exactly what's the energy of the reactants or products to know how temperature would change the balance.
Right now,
and that, yeah, we haven't been looking at temperature. All right, so I know you don't have them to look at because you just took them, but let's go over the answers to this quiz you just took. Because you still have SN1 and SN2 that will show up on this exam. We're working with E1 and E2, but if we're going to be talking about E1 versus E2, SN1 versus SN2, should know these factors that were played with in these five different reactions that you had to deal with. Now, the first question that was on the quiz, I'll just ask you to refer back to the notes because the three factors were hybridization, inductive effect, and resonance effect, exactly the three things that we had talked about in lecture. So, for example, the difference between the alkane and alkyne, that was hybridization. That was the only thing that was present. Between the alkane and the alcohol, that's the inductive effect, because oxygen can tolerate that negative charge versus carbon, which isn't as electronegative, so it's not as good as pulling electrons away. And then you have that alcohol versus the carboxylic acid, where yes, you put a second oxygen on there, but you have resonance, that once that hydrogen from the acid comes off, you have resonance stabilization, which is why it would want to come off in the first place. So let's do those five pairs of reactions. And let me write those out real quickly. So first one, primary alkyl halide with sodium hydroxide, secondary alkyl halide with sodium hydroxide. So since this was post-test, you were now responsible for knowing those six aspects of the different reactions, SN1 versus SN2. One of those aspects is to recognize that SN2 is a reaction that prefers primary versus secondary substrates and prefers strong nucleophiles. So if you look at sodium hydroxide, that is a strong basic nucleophile, so it's going to encourage SN2 reaction. So since we have a primary versus secondary substrate, you might remember that we discussed steric hindrance as being the reason why primaries are more reactive. So it is going to be the first reaction that is the faster one. Product of the reaction then would be this, where the hydroxide is going to substitute for the bromine, and you're going to have inversion of configuration. If you didn't mention it, that's okay. Because that's exactly why I asked the question this way, that I didn't want to hint what things to discuss or show in the mechanism, because that was part of knowing what the mechanism was. So as long as you wrote the product down correctly, you would have showed that inversion of configuration. And I didn't ask for it again, the inversion part of it, because you already just had it on this test. So I was trying to save time in a sense. Question?
Okay.
Now the next pair, So again, you had a primary and a secondary. But now you have a weak nucleophile. You have water instead. That's a characteristic of the SN1 reaction. So secondary carbocations, which is what you'd form in an SN1 reaction, are more stable than primary carbocations. So again, that's going to mean that the first reaction is the more rapid one. For the products, again, implicit in this is what is the stereochemistry of the products, and you would get two of them. So let me write down next to this. So this is SN2, as we have a strong basic nucleophile, and primary is faster than secondary because of less steric hindrance. On the second one, this is SN1, where we have a weak non-basic nucleophile, and so secondary is faster than primary because of hyperconjugation. The third pair is exactly where this question of is it the same or not comes up. And this is the only one I might even try to call a trick question, but it's not really. Because what you might have been tempted to look at first is the difference between the oxygen and the sulfur. But that answer that we just went over from the exam, what's the rate limiting step of this SN1 reaction? How do we know it would have been SN1? Because again, we have a weak nucleophile. The only thing that affects reaction rate is the substrate itself. Since it's the same substrate in both cases, it's the same reaction rate. So again, SN1, because it's a weak non-basic nucleophile, and again, since it's the same substrate, it's the same rate. Yes? It is. But if you have the same reaction, if all you're changing is the nucleophile, then they're going to be the same rate of reaction, because it's the same activation curve. So K would be the same. And I guess you'd have to say implicit in this is there were no concentrations measured. It's really focusing on mechanism. So right. Yep. Shown that you had any change in concentration, then you'd have the same rate of reaction. Then the fourth pair here, this is going to be SN2, because we have strong Even if it's not that basic, SH minus is technically basic. It's definitely a strong nucleophile, though. And in fact, the point of this question is it's going to be a stronger nucleophile than oxygen because of polarizability. So sulfur, bigger, squishier than oxygen, more polarizable, that's going to be the better nucleophile. And so that will be the product for that one. Yes. Oh, I didn't draw a structure, sorry. They both look the same, just oxygen versus sulfur, so I'll do the first one. So you get an ether or a disulfide. Or not disulfide, a sulfide. Yes.
And if you said, that's what someone asked, and that's why I said it out loud, because I did mean it. And if you wanted to use the word squishy, you were through, you could have felt free to use it. Since I used it myself, I got to let you use it, right? Yes.
Then the last pair of reactions. Last pair was with a mesylate. Being substituted with sodium hydroxide and fluoride with sodium hydroxide. Fluoride is the conjugate of a weak acid. It is the one halogen that we discussed in lecture being a poor leaving group because it comes from a weak acid. A mesylate, that is the conjugate base of a strong acid. Remember that in terms of leaving group ability, the stronger the acid it comes from, the conjugate, the better leaving group it's going to be. Since this is an SN2 reaction, we're actually, you're using the same nucleophile. So even an SN1 or an SN2 reaction, for both cases, it would be the mesylate that would be the better group, so it would be the faster reaction. It is SN2 in this case, though, because we have strong basic nucleophiles and a primary substrate. And again, tosylate, good leaving group. Fluoride, since it's basic, is a bad leaving group. Or sorry, not tosylate, mesylate. So the product structure in this case would be this. Yes? Sodium hydroxide is a salt. There's no solvent being shown. And whether it was protic or aprotic solvents, that could affect the fluoride or halogen as far as it being a nucleophile. Regardless of the type of solvent you have, though, the mesylate is still going to be a better leaving group than fluoride. So if you had a protic solvent, it would slow down hydroxide, but the relative rates between the two, or which one is faster, I should say, would still be the same. Yes. As far as specific grading questions, let me see all the quizzes first, so I grade them all the same way. Yes. Again, if it's about specific grading, let me answer that. But in general, if you said it's a good leaking proof because it has resonant stabilization where fluorine doesn't, that is correct. Whether that's correct enough, I'm going to have to decide. So we're at, yes, it is 12:30. So let's take a short break, and then we'll come back for a short lecture, and then the rest of the lab period you'll have to work on your IRs and NMRs. So I'll be back in just a few minutes. SN2 versus SN1 versus E2 versus E1. Everything that we've discussed so far today has so far been lecture. So what I may do, in fact, is combine the itty-bitty bit of lecture we had in lecture with this and post it all under the lecture recording. And then when we switch over to talk about lab reports, obviously that will be for lab. All right. So S1, S2, E1, E2. Think about the things that can influence which one of these is going to happen. It's not really going to be the leaving group. Because if you change one leaving group versus the other, technically, that can cause a change in distribution of products if you've got elimination going on. But the nucleophile is also involved, and if you're using the same nucleophile, well, I guess what I'm trying to say is leaving group isn't really one of the strong factors. It is, in fact, just the substrate and what kind of nucleophile that you're trying to use. And so it might be easier to first think about substitution versus elimination, instead of trying to tackle all four distinctions at once. So substitution's going to happen if you don't have something that's trying to get in there and grab that proton, especially if you're talking about SN2 versus E2. SN2, nucleophile has to attack. You just got to make sure it's not basic enough that it's going to pull a proton off instead. Now, we did discover, though, that SN1 can't happen without the chance of E1 and vice versa. So there's always going to be this footnote that we got to make. In any discussion we have about SN1 and E1, remember, both of them could, in theory, happen. So I guess if we're focusing on the SN2 versus E2 reactions, let's just take a couple examples to work with, and maybe we can build a small table. So, ethyl bromide with sodium hydroxide, primary substituent, primary leaving group, about as sterically unhindered as you can get other than having a methyl group. And so I've shown this as the major product. Is elimination technically possible? Yes. If somehow hydroxide, being basic, is able to rip a proton off over here, there's nothing that would prevent that from happening, but it would be a very minor product in this case because substitution is not difficult. What if we had something like this, though? This is actually the tough case, what to do about secondaries. And because secondaries in between good and bad for SN1, and it's between good and bad for SN2. It's also in between for SN2 versus E2, because there's enough steric hindrance now where you will slow substitution down enough that elimination becomes a non-zero possibility. So if you had just hydroxide, one of the smallest basic nucleophiles that you can have. It is possible to get more SN2 than E2. So I'm going to write for the major product in this case. That we're going to get substitution. But I'm going to acknowledge the fact that with that extra bit of steric hindrance, we're also going to have the possibility of elimination. So primary is going to be SN2. Secondary is going to be SN2 and E2. Unless you've got a hindered nucleophile. You might remember that we saw this ion, the T-butoxide ion, last week when we were talking about eliminations. And this T-butoxide ion is itself so hindered that it's really not going to have a chance to substitute. So yes, when we first went through the SN1, SN2 reactions, for SN2 we talked about how steric hindrance of the substrate has an influence. But now we're focusing on the nucleophile. In this case, almost exclusively, the product is just going to be E2. So secondary with bulky base is E2. Tertiary doesn't do SN2, and so if you have a basic nucleophile, the only thing possible is E2. Yeah, really, these are the four examples we have to worry about if we're dealing with basic nucleophiles. Well, what if you get, if you have non-basic nucleophiles? So let's break these cases down. So, primary alkyl halide with water. Technically, you might get a trace of SN2, just an little bitty bit. But water is not basic, so that reaction's really not favorable. And so it would just have to be a time exposure thing, where you leave the compounds out for a long time before you really encourage any SN2 to occur. SN1 flat out won't happen. So you will get a product, but big asterisk here, it is a slow SN2 reaction. For anything else, it's SN1 and E1. For anything besides primary, secondary or tertiary, that means, you're going to have SN1 and E1 if you have a non-basic, non-basic weak nucleophile. Now, as we're going through all this, you might get a little bit worried, oh my gosh, there's all these different cases. And that is what is one of the difficult aspects of this reaction. But I'm also going to let you know, I'm not out to figure out, can I figure out just the right substrate and just the right nucleophile? Well, you'd never be able to predict the product of reaction, because there's no point to that. I want to know, do you know the general trends? Big, bulky base that can't get to do a substitution means it's going to eliminate. That's the kind of thing that I want you to know, or what we're about to write down here. Non-basic, non-strong nucleophile, that's when SN1 and E1 are going to be possible. Those are the types of decisions I want you to be able to make. Some texts, and to be honest, I haven't reviewed our text yet as far as how much differentiation it gets into. But a lot of texts go overboard.
They get into, what about this case? What about that one? What about that one? What about that one? Not that it's not important, not that it's not valid, but it's not as important as anything else we've discussed so far. Unless you were a chem major in an advanced organic chemistry course. So in the future, we may see some of these more special cases in 12B if they come up in context of other reactions that we're learning. So what I guess I'm trying to tell you is you may read more cases in the book, but I'm only going to be quizzing or testing on the types of differentiations I'm making right now. So
back to these cases, if we have a secondary alkyl halide and we have water, it's going to be much more likely that if substitution occurs, it's going to just be SN1. Again, because it's not a basic nucleophile, so SN2 is not very likely. But because SN1 has the same intermediate as E1, you will get some quantity of the alkene as well. So secondary, oh, I forgot to say here. Primary will be slow SN2. Secondary will be E1 and SN1. Tertiary. It really depends on the solvent and the temperature.
So we can't predict.
Not generally. Now, usually, if you have a non-hindered nucleophile, you might get a bit more substitution. Just because if it's not all that big, it can get in there and substitute at the carbocation. Generally, if you have a bulky nucleophile, you might have a little bit more of elimination. But even in that bulky nucleophile case, because it's not basic, the carbocation has time to sit around and form and maybe persist, you will get substitution. So it's very solution and nucleophile dependent. So I will never ask you to distinguish one versus the other of these. Again, for an advanced OCHEM course, we might have a long discussion about it. For this level of OCHEM, it's a little overkill.
So here we'll have substitution and elimination. And this was for the cases of non-basic nucleophiles.
So if I want to summarize, I'm sorry, question. So let me summarize the factors that I gave at the beginning of this, which are that it is the substrate and how basic and bulky the nucleophile is that will determine which one of the reaction mechanisms occurs.
Oops.
Now, the last thing I want to show you then is leading up to a type of problem that you're going to have on all exams from now on, which I think I might have given a preview of that early in the quarter. And it's what is known as the fill-in-the-blank problem.
So, for example, let's say you have something like this. Let's say that we have a tosylate. That I show reacting with something, but that something is not shown. And I show an ether as the product.
In this type of question, then, I would ask you, what should go in the blank? Well, what should go in the blank in this case? What compound would go in the blank? What's that? So I heard NaOH, strong nucleophile. Any other guesses? Something that what? Ah, but that's the point. Would this undergo SN2? No, because it's a tertiary substrate. So you can't use strong nucleophiles, you can't use hydroxide, because you would get elimination instead. And so that's exactly the point of what we just discussed previously, how to decide which type of reaction is going to occur. So if you see something like this, you have to analyze it and say, oh, okay, tertiary substrate, but substitution. The only possible reaction is SN1. So, since it's tertiary, but it's substitution, only SN1 is possible, which means whatever our answer is going to have to be a weak, non-basic nucleophile. Now, hydroxide, if we used water instead, that would give us an alcohol instead of an ether as a product. So the other consideration is, what's the carbon structure of the product? We have two new carbons in the product that really weren't in the reactant. And so we're going to want a two-carbon compound to be our nucleophile, which means the answer is ethanol. Now let's do another example where I have the product missing instead of the reagent.
Of course, you've indirectly had something like that already from your quiz. So let's see if I can think of another creative example. What about this? Let's start introducing some other nucleophiles that we haven't seen very much of.
CN is the cyanide ion, which, take 10, 15 seconds, figure out if you could write a real quick Lewis dot structure for the cyanide ion. It does. So carbon, 4 valence electrons, nitrogen, 5 valence electrons, negatively charged ion. So 1 plus 4 plus 5 gives us 10 electrons total.
We have carbon and nitrogen. The only way we could squeeze 10 electrons around those is to make a triple bond between the carbon and nitrogen and put a lone pair on each. Nitrogen's going to be neutral if we do that. Carbon's going to be negatively charged.
So this is a basic nucleophile. It's relatively strong. Carbon's going to be the business end of it, so you'll form new carbon-carbon bonds. which is a hugely important trick, because what we're going to find out is that the formation and breaking of carbon-carbon bonds are some of the most important reactions in organic chemistry. There are many more reactions that transform functional groups, but to combine and cleave carbon bonds, that's a bit rarer. This is a sneaky way of doing it because we're just doing a substitution, but it makes a carbon-carbon bond. Now, you had a question. Because the only way to put the negative charge on nitrogen would be to make a quadruple bond, which is not possible. So, yes?
So you know it's basic because of the negative charge?
You don't know it's basic. I'm actually telling you it's basic. Hydrogen cyanide has a pKa of somewhere between 9 and 10. So that's not as good a base as hydroxide, but it's a stronger base than fluoride is. For the common nucleophiles, no. So you'll be expected to know, for example, that oxygen minus is a type of nucleophile that is basic. You'll need to know that this is basic as well. If there's a question that needs it, I'll give you that information. But no, this, if you look in the book, there's a table of good nucleophiles, bad nucleophiles. This is one of the ones that's under good, that's under the basic ones. So, if that is a basic nucleophile, what kind of reaction is going to happen here?
SN2.
Why? Primary substrate. So, combination of primary substrate and basic nucleophile that's not very hindered, so it's going to be SN2.
So the product's going to be this, which this functional group is known as a nitrile.
Nitriles can be converted into other carboxylic acid derivatives. So this is our sneaky way of introducing a carbon-carbon bond to later make carboxylic acid derivatives, which can be used to make aldehydes and ketones, which can be used to make alkenes and alkynes. One more example, I guess, where we leave the... Oh, I'm sorry, yes? Then you might have some elimination possible, yes. And if you used a really hindered base, yes, you could get elimination. But we didn't in this case, so that's why the major product's substitution. What's that? It depends on the type of question. So far, the only type of question you've had is, well, like today, where you're just filling in a product, or you have had mechanism questions. Later on, you'll have mechanism questions, these fill-in-the-blank questions, and the next quarter, you'll have a third type of question, synthesis question. This quarter, we're not going to have the time to build synthesis like I'd like to, so it wouldn't be fair to ask that type of question yet. But I'm going to, at the end of the quarter, we're going to go see where we're going to head with that. So you'll still have questions where it'll be mechanism, but the question will clearly state to write the mechanism. So let's do one more quick example, and then we need to shift to talk about lab reports. So something reacts with potassium T-butoxide to make this compound. So, what kind of reaction would have occurred? E2, Why? Because we made an alkene. That's one of the big clues that elimination happened instead of substitution. The other clue is that there's nothing that looks like either a nucleophile or a leaving group on the end molecule. So E2 would have occurred. Why E2 and not E1? Has to do with the nucleophile. What kind of nucleophile is this? It's bulky, it's tertiary, it's basic. But remember, potassium, that's an ion. So even though I wrote it as OK, it really is oxygen minus. So it's a hindered, bulky, basic nucleophile, which means it's E2 instead of E1. So that means we have to work backwards and figure out where to put the halogen. Now, if I wanted to make sure this was the only product form, then that means I would not want to put the halogen where my pen is right now. Because if you eliminated that alkene, you could have elimination in two different directions. So if you wanted to ensure that you only had this product, we want to make sure that the bromine leaving group in general is at this top position. So let me just show you this. That if we had had the halogen or leaving group here, we won't even worry about stereochemistry in this case. And even if I use sodium hydroxide, that's a tertiary substrate, so even sodium hydroxide could cause elimination. And it would cause the formation of two products. And because of that, this is not the ideal location for the leaving group. Since two products can be formed. So instead, we'll put the leaving group at this top position. But remember the discussion that we had in lecture today about the need for the leaving group and the hydrogen to be removed to be trans to each other. So once we put that leaving group up there, we would technically have a number of choices. One choice would be this, which is fine, because the correct The correct elimination geometry is possible. Another choice would be it's enantiomer. I won't write that down because if it's the enantiomer, it's going to be the same thing. You still have the correct geometry possible. But if I look at its diastereomer, where in this case I'll write the hydrogen in explicitly, to show that they're cis. In fact, I'll go ahead and do that over here as well and highlight that these are trans to each other and these are cis to each other. This would not be a correct answer because the correct elimination geometry is not possible. So this is the new type of problem that you'll have on exam 3. where the reagent, the product, or the substrate may be missing. And this is exactly how you have to rationalize through it. You look to see what the substrate is or what the product is if you don't have the substrate. You look at the nucleophile, and between the two of those, you figure out which kind of mechanism had to happen. From there, then you can try to tailor the nucleophile correctly, if that's what you're being asked for, or come up with an appropriate structure for the product or the substrate. Yes? That's right. And so that's why only this first answer would have been an acceptable answer to this kind of problem. Questions? Then let me pause and flip over to a lab recording then.